Welcome to the broadcast. Brother Eric John Phelps, 24/7 World Radio, with this podcast today on March the 10th, 2024, which is a Sunday, the Lord's Day. Welcome again to the broadcast. This broadcast will be another brief explication of what has happened to us in the last 91 years that we have been ruled by an emergency war powers military government that was imposed upon us by the Masonic Lodge, Scottish Rite Freemasons, subject to the Jesuits of Georgetown and other universities, on March 9th, 1933. This is a topic that is not spoken of very often by any academic, by any jurist, by any judge, by any senator, by any individual in public service, because the vast majority do not know that they are living under emergency war powers military government for the last 91 years as of yesterday, which was March 9th, 2024. This emergency war powers military government imposed on March 9th, 1933, by Franklin Damnable Roosevelt, that abject slave and tool of the Roman papacy, and at the time, subject to the popes, the Archbishop of New York Council on Foreign Relations, Tammany Hall, where all the Irish Catholics were there, busy controlling the Democratic Party, particularly Al Smith and James Farley and John Flynn and the builder of the Empire State Building, John J. Raskob, all of these men being Knights of Malta, subject to the Pope in conquering America, as the Jesuits had promised that they would do, as Shinnequy foresaw in his great book, 50 Years in the Church of Rome. Remember, Charles Shinnequy was looked upon as the Martin Luther of North America, and he was the one who exposed the Jesuits as the true assassins of Abraham Lincoln in his great book, 50 Years in the Church of Rome. So I shall review a few irrefutable facts. The first one is that the Jesuit order, with its high-level Scottish Rite Freemasons, were responsible for the war between the states from 1861 to 1865. Freemasons were on both sides, and Jesuit-controlled knights were on both sides, and they worked it together so the South would lose, and on the ruins of the lost South that was historically white, Anglo-Saxon, Protestant, and Baptist, they would erect on both the North and the South an empire, at first a national republic. The republic would cease to be a federal republic on July 28, 1868, and it would be broadened and enlarged into a national republic, because the federal citizenship that began in 1789 and went through till July 27th, 1868, would be changed, it would be enlarged, it would be broadened from just white people having federal citizenship into both whites and blacks and later Asians having national citizenship. So the republic was changed from a federal republic to a national republic. Still, they had a civilian form of government, but it was enlarged. Its powers were enlarged on July 28, 1868, and this is the reason why the war was fought on the part of the South against the North. They did not want this centralization of power. They did not want this, as was warned by Jefferson when he was the opponent of Alexander Hamilton. Remember, Jefferson wanted limited powers of the federal government and was a champion of the rights of the states that were reserved to the states, while certain of those rights of the states had been delegated to the federal government in 1789. And so they were contending for the rights of the states. The federal government, run by Abraham Lincoln, with the radical red Republicans that generally hated him, men like Thaddeus Stevens and Charles Sumner and John Bingham, and a host of other radical red Republicans that essentially hated Lincoln, not to mention Secretary of War Edwin M. Stanton, who was one of the key players in the orchestrating of the assassination of Abraham Lincoln. Make sure you get the book, They Wanted Lincoln Dead, where it is absolutely proven that he was the overseer of it, and I would add, aided and abetted and really guided by the Jesuit Bernardine F. Wiggett from Georgetown University, that the war resulted in exactly what the Jesuits wanted, centralization of power that would create or broaden the federal republic into a national republic. This happened. And the next great event would be March 9th, 1933. This is when the Jesuits, having promised to take the United States of America, as they had promised so to do in 1852 when they had a secret meeting in Buffalo, New York, as documented by Charles Chiniquy, the great priest who got saved, came to know the Lord, and became the Martin Luther of North America. He documents in his book the 50 years in the Church of Rome that the Jesuits were going to take this country. All of it. And this was a meeting in 1852 where they said they would. So in their quest to destroy the white Anglo-Saxon Protestant Western civilization and Western nations born out of the Reformation, they had to bring down America because it was the greatest nation ever founded in world history, with the greatest written constitution ever ratified and put into place in world history. Our American Revolution was the greatest revolution in world history. We were to never win that. For those of you interested in more of this history, you must read the great work called The Chaplains and Clergy of the Revolution by J.T. Headley. I'm one, probably my favorite American historian. So, the Jesuits would take this country on March 9th, 1933. So, here is what they did. They first of all had caused World War I. And this was a violation of the wonderful Monroe Doctrine, and got the civilian national government involved in a foreign war in Europe. This was a violation of the Monroe Doctrine. And certain ones that facilitated this were Joseph Tumulty, who was the overseer of President Woodrow Wilson. Mr. Tumulty was a Knight of Columbus. He was the overseer of Wilson for 10 years. He oversaw him when Wilson was the governor of New Jersey for 2 years and when he was president for 8 years. So, Mr. Tumulty was a high-level Knight of Columbus, overseeing Wilson on behalf of the Archbishop of Baltimore and the head of the Knights of Columbus that were running the Tammany Hall, the Democratic Party there in New York City. So, Woodrow Wilson brought this country into World War I, which was a sin and a crime and very evil and very wicked. As a result of this, America is then brought into the Roaring Twenties. The Roaring Twenties was a time when the Pope's Federal Reserve Bank extended credit by the hundreds of millions into the economy, and it created a false sense of prosperity. And the farmers were seduced into investing into Wall Street by men like John J. Raskob, who was a Knight of Malta and the builder of the Empire State Building, and the head of DuPont and General Motors during World War I, after which he would sell his interests in those massive companies and take the money from that and build the Empire State Building. So the Empire State Building has always been owned and controlled by the Knights of Malta. In the days of the Kennedy assassination, the owner and controller of the Empire State Building was J. Peter Grace, the head of the Knights of Malta in America and the chief overseer of the Knights of Malta involved in the Kennedy assassination on November 22, 1963. So, we have the Roaring Twenties. The order is given by the Pope to withdraw the credit in the United States, 40% of it. And so the Federal Reserve Bank, controlled by the papacy, withdraws 40% of the credit in circulation. And Joe Kennedy is the chief of three short sellers of stock on Wall Street that will throw the nation into a panic. And between these two things, being short selling of the stock by Knight of Malta Joe Kennedy, who will go on to be the ambassador to England at St. James there in England, the economy will crash in 1929. This is exactly what the Jesuits wanted. This is exactly what their high Knights of Malta wanted. This is exactly what the high Freemasons wanted. This is exactly what the high Skull and Bonesmen wanted. All of them working for the papacy, for the purpose of destroying the Reformation of Western civilization. So, they caused the huge stock market crash, and FDR comes along as the hero of the hour to save the country. He's put on a white horse. And when FDR is elected in late 1932, he comes to power in early 1933. He is sworn in on March 4th, 1933, which will be the last time an American president will be sworn in on March 4th. After that, the three successive terms of FDR, he will be sworn in on January 20th, pursuant to the 20th Amendment that changed the swearing in of the president, the inauguration, from March 4th to January 20th, with the 20th Amendment to the Constitution. FDR then, when he becomes president, when he's sworn in on March 4th, 1933, which is a Saturday, he promises that he will invoke war powers as though he were engaged in a war with a foreign foe over this economic crisis. On Monday, March 6th, 1933, he will proclaim the Proclamation 2039 based on Section 5B of the Act of October 6, 1917, which is the Trading with the Enemy Act. So he will invoke war powers out of Trading with the Enemy Act that had been amended 14 times from 1918 to 1930, fashioned for this very moment that FDR should use it to call upon and to invoke emergency war powers in the attempt to solve the horrible, terrible economic crisis caused by the papacy in October of 1929. So, what he does is, in so doing, he imposes emergency war powers military government, and he ousts civilian government. This is the great coup d'etat in the United States at this time. So with this coup d'etat, he ousts the national civilian government of the United States and imposes a national emergency war powers military government, claimed to be only temporary or provisional, until the crisis be solved, and that he would terminate this proclamation with a termination proclamation as set forth on March 9th, 1933, which would be Thursday, after the Congress had allegedly passed the Emergency Banking Relief Act, approving and confirming all proclamations since March 4th, 1933, ad infinitum to any other proclamations thereafter. So now FDR had imposed emergency war powers military government. The next step was to then begin to impose his New Deal. The New Deal is sheer socialist communism, authored and written up by the Jesuits of Georgetown, because the Jesuits are the masters of communism. They perfected communism on their Paraguayan reductions from 1609 to 1759 for 150 years, as I cover in my book, Vatican Assassins, Wounded in the House of My Friends, 2007, third edition. And so, with this imposition of emergency war powers military government on Monday, FDR closes all the banks for 4 days and declares a banking holiday. This means nobody can come and get their gold in the banks. Nobody can come and get their cash from the banks. They've rendered business and individuals absolutely powerless to do anything financial for 4 days. The president then calls for an emergency session of Congress. And calling for this emergency session of Congress on March 5th, the day after he's inaugurated, that emergency session will convene on March 9th, 1933. This will be the great day that the Jesuits will finalize the taking of every person, every place, everything in the United States of America that white Anglo-Saxon Protestant and Baptist heretic nation that needs to be destroyed from the face of the whole earth, pursuant to the Jesuit orders, Council of Trent, and Fourth Vow, the Oath of Extreme Induction. We continue on now, and so the Jesuits have taken everything on Monday. Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, they have their banking holiday. The Congress convenes in an emergency session called the Emergency Banking Relief Act, and here it is proclaimed, it is passed by the chair. The chair deems it to be have been passed without a roll call. Nobody knew who wrote the act. Nobody had a copy of the act. It was read to them 3 times like little children by the Speaker of the House. And on the 3rd time, at the behest of Jimmy Burns, that conspirator, that Roman Catholic out of South Carolina, that congressman, the Speaker of the House will declare it to have been passed, where every proclamation from March 4th, the day of the inauguration of FDR, up to the present, shall be approved and confirmed. Section 2 of the Act will then enlarge the Trading with the Enemy Act by removing a provision that limits the Trading with the Enemy Act to only domestic transactions, and that little provision is removed, so the Trading with the Enemy Act, Section 5B, applies to all domestic transactions as well as all foreign and domestic transactions. This greatly enlarges the power of Congress. And so, this brings Trading with the Enemy Act inland. Just as the Jesuits had brought the Admiralty jurisdiction inland in Great Britain prior to the days of Cromwell, and this was one of the great remonstrances that the Puritans set forth in their great remonstrance of 1641, thereabouts, that the king, King Charles I, had brought the Admiralty jurisdiction inland. That would then set aside common law, the wonderful provisions of the common law of England, and hence the Jesuits would do essentially the same thing here in America when they brought Trading with the Enemy Act inland, and they would take the jurisdiction conferred on the federal district courts of Section 17 of the Trading with the Enemy Act. And that jurisdiction then would ultimately be made to be the absolute jurisdiction of all the federal district courts. But the Jesuits had to wait for 5 years. So from 1933 to 1938, things were being put in place to impose the Emergency War Powers Military Jurisdiction of the Trading with the Enemy Act on all the states and all the people and all the businesses. Remember that FDR had seized every person, every place, everything, all the counties, all the states, on March 9th, 1933, under the doctrine of the necessity of war. This is when the commander-in-chief will begin to wage war on all the people of the United States, now deemed to be enemy belligerents, deemed to be enemies or persons, enemies under Trading with the Enemy Act, persons on the Emergency Banking Relief Act, U.S. citizens. And now he's waging war on all the states and all the people of the United States deemed enemy belligerents, waging war from the District of Columbia, which is his Rome on the Potomac. And that's why it was given a government in 1871 in preparation for March 9th, 1933. So, 5 years takes place. The Supreme Court is resistant. And so FDR is told he needs to pack the court. So, two Supreme Court justices that are Republicans and conservatives resign in February of 1938. And they are replaced by two left-wing socialist communists, Fabian socialist Democrats, named Stanley Reed and Hugo Black, who was a 33rd degree Freemason and a member of the Ku Klux Klan. That's right. FDR appointed a member of the second Klan that had been created in 1913, 1915, thereabouts, when the first Klan had been abolished in 1869 by the great Nathan Bedford Forrest, the great Lieutenant General and Confederate officer that abolished the Klan at that time in 1869. So the second Klan, Hugo Black was a member of it, 33rd degree Freemason. And so the Supreme Court is now packed and ready to make radical decisions to approve certain of the Jesuit Order's New Deal. And in facilitating this, the Jesuits know they have to impose an Emergency War Powers military jurisdiction on the federal district courts that would be exclusive, that there would be no more civilian due process of law in the federal district courts. And so the Jesuits, in preparing for this moment, had used their tools to bring a case up on appeal to the Supreme Court by 1938. So in April, on April 25th of 1938, the Jesuits would have their Erie decision decided, where they would abolish federal general common law. This was a civilian due process. Now, common law, federal common law, exists on a federal level, but it's not the old federal general common law. It is a new common law. It is a federal common law. It is a federal common law that is judge-made by case basis. And this is an emergency war powers federal common law. It is not a civilian due process common law. It is a military due process federal common law. And the twain, the federal general common law and the federal common law of military due process, shall never meet. So always distinguish between the two. Now, with the Erie decision, the Supreme Court decided there was no more federal general common law, which question had not been brought properly before the court. And you can read this in, I believe it's Judge Butler's dissent in the Erie decision. He said this question, this is an act of judicial activism, this question had never been brought up in the federal district court, in the court of appeals, the circuit court of appeals, and now it's going to be decided in the Supreme Court, which the question had not been properly brought before it. The Erie decision was the most criminal, filthy, despicable decision ever handed up to us, ever handed down to us, because now we're the conquered people since March 9th, 1933. And so, it's imposed what it did when it abolished federal general common law. It abolished civilian due process of law, and therefore created a vacuum for the Trading with the Enemy Act special jurisdiction conferred on the district court for the enforcement of Trading with the Enemy Act. That's Section 17. It's codified now at 50 U.S.C. 4316. And so it codified there at that's a federal jurisdiction, 4316. Let me just check that for a second. Correct. It is 50 U.S.C. 4316, and here's how it reads. The district courts of the United States are given jurisdiction to make and enter all such rules as to notice and otherwise, and all such orders and decrees, and to issue such process as may be necessary and proper in the premises to enforce the provisions of this chapter. This has to do with Trading with the Enemy Act. It was first put in place in 1917 during World War I. So this special jurisdiction, it's an emergency war powers jurisdiction. It is created by the Congress and put upon the district courts of the United States to exclusively use it for the enforcement of Trading with the Enemy Act, which is okay during World War I. But they kept that Trading with the Enemy Act in place, and they amended it, 14 times from 1918 to 1930. And now, with this extending of the Trading with the Enemy Act into the country with the Emergency Banking Relief Act, they now are able to impose this jurisdiction on all federal courts, providing the Erie decision would be handed down. The Erie decision was the bulwark keeping this jurisdiction, this military jurisdiction of the Trading with the Enemy Act, from being all-encompassing. And so now, when the Erie decision is made, this particular military jurisdiction of the Trading with the Enemy Act is now imposed. It fills the vacuum of what was once our beautiful civilian jurisdiction of Article 3, Section 2, Clause 1. All suits of law, equity, and admiralty, maritime jurisdiction, those were all civilian due process procedures, jurisdictions, or I should say jurisprudences. At law was common law. In equity was equity jurisprudence. Admiralty, maritime is synonymous. All of these are specific jurisprudences within the civilian due process of law jurisdiction of Article 3 of the Constitution. Now that they had overturned civilian due process of law as of April 25th, 1938, this provision of the Trading with the Enemy Act, which is now 50 U.S.C. 4316, is now the jurisdiction in which every federal district court will sit for both civil and criminal matters. There is no civilian due process of law in any federal district court today. And one of the evidences of that is every federal court is flying military colors. When I was just in Spokane, just about a month or so ago, I went up to the federal building there. It's, in Spokane? Thomas Foley Federal Building. Went up to the ninth floor, decided to sit in on a proceeding where they had some savage Hispanic alien invader there, putting him on trial for having a gun. He was there illegally. And right there, we have a female judge, we have a female court reporter, we have a female clerk, all females up there. The only male in part of the government was a U.S. attorney. And so what we have there is a military color, and I took a picture of it. If you're interested, I'll send it to you. But there it is, a United States flag trimmed in gold fringe on three sides with gold cord and tassels at each end. This is a military color. It is not an admiralty jurisdiction. It is an emergency war powers military jurisdiction, and it is proceeding according to the course of admiralty jurisprudence. Admiralty jurisprudence was a federal jurisprudence. No state ever had admiralty jurisprudence after it delegated its power of admiralty jurisprudence to the federal government. No state had any war powers after it had delegated its war powers to the federal government, 1789. So this implementation of emergency war powers jurisdiction, military jurisdiction, and thus emergency war powers admiralty jurisprudence to guide the military jurisdiction, is they are both federal. That also tells you that every state court, no state court is sitting in a civilian due process of law, because no state court, all the civilian due process of law of every state has been overlaid with the emergency war powers military jurisdiction, the national jurisdiction, not federal but national. Remember, we have not had a federal government since July 28, 1868. We've had a national government since then. So it's a national government, a military government, and the jurisprudence that it follows is the national jurisprudence of admiralty jurisprudence. And what's another evidence that it's sitting in emergency war powers military jurisdiction? Well, everybody's deemed as an enemy belligerent. Otherwise, they could not be given an emergency war powers military due process of law. That's why they're deemed to be persons living in occupied territories. Their county is an occupied territory. Their state is an occupied territory. Why? Because these counties and states have all been seized by the commander-in-chief. And the commander-in-chief has legal title to every person, every individual, every piece of land in this country, every chattel, every movable piece of property, everything, every corporation, the commander-in-chief has legal title thereto, including the Federal Reserve Bank. That's why the Pope must control the commander-in-chief. That's why the commander-in-chief, every commander-in-chief, no matter if he's a Democrat or Republican, takes a trip to Rome and visits his master, the Pope, and is told what to do. And you be a good boy, and we won't kill you like we killed Kennedy. That's right. By the way, take Donald Trump downstairs in the Vatican here and show him the real Zapruder film so he can see what we're going to do to him if he doesn't do what we tell him to do. And same way with Joey Biden, we do the same thing with him. The Pope rules the world. He rules this country since no later than March 9th, 1933. And woe be to the president or commander-in-chief that thinks he can disobey him. So, we live under an emergency war powers military government since March 9, 1933. We've been under emergency war powers military jurisdiction since April 25, 1938 with the Erie decision, and simultaneously imposed admiralty jurisprudence to be the guiding jurisprudence of the military jurisdiction in every federal and in every state court. That's where we are today. So, on September 16th, 1938, the Supreme Court will back the merging of the rules of federal rules of civil procedure. Before that time, you had rules for at law, at common law, and you had rules for equity procedures in the federal courts. Now, with the new military jurisdiction, emergency war powers military jurisdiction they imposed, we need a new set of rules. So we're going to merge those old rules together with what's this? I think it's rule number 2 in the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure. And we're going to merge them all together. That will include admiralty procedures. And we're going to merge them all under one set of rules for civil procedures. The federal rules for criminal procedure will just be merely criminal rules fitted for this military jurisdiction, proceeding according to the course of admiralty jurisprudence, because admiralty jurisprudence has both a civil and a criminal jurisdiction. And I learned that from Joseph Story in his great work, The Constitution, Commentaries on the Constitution. It's also in the statute. I, for years, taught it incorrectly, thinking that admiralty only had a civil jurisdiction, but it has both a civil and criminal jurisdiction. And that's admiralty jurisprudence. Remember, the courts are not admiralty courts. The courts are not sitting in admiralty jurisdiction. Unlike the CIA, Control of Patriot Movement wants to tell you, the courts are sitting in emergency war powers military jurisdiction with its military due process, proceeding according to the course of admiralty jurisprudence. That's how it works. And remember, admiralty jurisprudence follows a Roman civil law, just like equity does. Roman equity follows a Roman civil law. So, September 16th, they merged the rules. And now, they're ready to rock and roll in their courts with their new flags on display. And no judge will ever talk about any military color on display in its court. That no judge will ever talk about it. And I tried talking about it with several of them. I tried talking about it with Judge Sylvia Rambo in the Middle District for Pennsylvania, after whom they named their new federal building in Harrisburg, Sylvia Rambo. Yet Sylvia Rambo will not be honest enough to ever deal with the fact that military colors were in her courtroom for years. Like Christopher Connor, who was the Chief Justice for many years. It's in his courtroom, and him will never deal with it. None of these judges in any federal district court will ever have the courage enough to tell the average individual, the average poor enemy belligerent of America under military occupation, that our flags are military colors sitting in the courts, boy. And if you think you have common law rights in these military courts, in these beautiful Article III courts sitting in temporary emergency war powers military jurisdiction, proceeding according to the course of American admiralty jurisprudence, you got another thing coming, boy. You see how the legal profession has nothing but contempt for us? And I'm a pre-March 9th, 1933 private citizen. It doesn't have contempt for me because I got free. And they have to protect me pursuant to the Hague Convention, pursuant to Article 23H. And if they don't, they will be committing a war crime. And a war crime can be punishable by death. They left the way out for you to become a pre-March 9th, 1933 private citizen, which I teach. It takes a 3-day course. It's $2,500. It's a gift to the ministry here, Reformation Bible Puritan Baptist Church. But it's my ministry to seek to restore what was taken from us in 1933. Because we all volunteered to be surety for the all capital letter entity known as the person, the enemy, the U.S. citizen. And furthermore, to prove that we are under an admiralty jurisprudence in every federal and every state court, every defendant must have a surety. In civilian due process of law, the defendant doesn't have to have a surety. But in an admiralty procedure, in admiralty jurisprudence, the defendant must always have a surety. We read on page, 46 of Benedict, the American Admiralty by Erastus C. Benedict, who is the master of American admiralty jurisprudence. Talks about the American Admiralty as jurisdiction and practice with practical forms and directions. We read on this particular section here, District Court Rules and Index. This is an 1850 out of New York. He says here, Rule 8. In suits for seamen's wages, any mariner in the same voyage not made a party may by short petition to the court in any stage of the cause previous to the final distribution of the fund in court, or discharge the defendant and his sureties, be joined as libelant in the cause, but no cost shall be allowed for the proceedings taken to make him a party. The defendant always has a surety. In the appendix to the book under Admiralty Rules, we read on page 339, bottom of the page, Rule 3. We read, in all suits in personam, that means against the person, where a simple warrant of arrest issues and is executed, the marshal may take bail with sufficient sureties from the party arrested by bond or stipulation, upon condition that he will appear in the suit and abide by all orders of the court, interlocutory, that's temporary, or final, in the cause and pay the money awarded by the final decree rendered therein in the court to which the process is returnable or in any appellate court. So this is a persona procedure against a person. It talks about arrest. This is a criminal matter. It talks about paying bail and the party arrested by bond or stipulation. So this idea of bonding out is an admiralty jurisprudence. And it goes on to say, and upon such bond or stipulation, summary process of execution may and shall be issued against the principal and sureties by the court. Well, the principal, in this instance, is the defendant, and it's his sureties. Against the principal and sureties by the court. So in every admiralty proceeding, there are sureties. There is no such thing at a common law proceeding, and there's no such thing in an equity proceeding. In every proceeding of every state court, every proceeding of federal district court, you, sir, you, ma'am, are the surety for your all capital letter entity, which is the enemy, the U.S. citizen, the belligerent, the person. It's not you, but you're one with it. You're bound with it by virtue of your consent, by silence. In the filing of the birth certificate and of the seizure by the commander-in-chief, he deems you one with that entity. And hence, that's how they can proceed against you in every criminal action and every civil proceeding, because you are presumed to be the defendant, surety for that defendant, one with that defendant. Now, I want to read the introduction to this great work by a man. Who wrote this introduction here? His name was Samuel R. Betts, judge of the United States for the Southern District of New York, who was an admiralty judge for nearly a quarter of a century, with so much honor to himself, has administered the maritime law in its simple and equitable spirit. This work is by permission inscribed in testimony of respect for his learning and ability, and with a grateful sense of his kindness and courtesy. So that's what Erastus C. Benedict wrote. But here's the preface. And the preface is going to be written by Mr. Betts. Okay. No, his preface is going to be written by Erastus Benedict, ECB. So here is his preface. And he devotes his book to Mr. Betts. Mr. Benedict writes here, "The practice of the admiralty courts of this country, notwithstanding the very considerable attention which has been sometimes given to it, has been so generally neglected that, with the exception of a few lawyers in the larger commercial cities, the whole bar make no secret of their ignorance of this branch of legal learning. Having imbibed the English notions on the subject, they have supposed the jurisdiction to be confined to a small class of cases, not worth the labor of learning a new course of proceeding." Remember, admiralty jurisprudence is a proceeding. All the federal district courts proceed according to admiralty jurisprudence today. All the state courts proceed according to the procedure of an admiralty jurisprudence. Going on, "They do not seem to have averted to that American view of the subject, which, springing out of the peculiar character of our institutions, considers the jurisdiction of that class of cases as a most important branch of the national sovereignty given to the general government for the wisest purposes. Every day gives new cause to admire the profound sagacity," that's farsightedness, "and practical wisdom and forecast of our fathers in providing for an unknown future and a territory to be extended indefinitely under the forms of our double government." The double government is the federal government acting upon the citizen and the state government acting upon the citizen. That's why he calls it a double government. That's what we still have today. "At this time in 1850, it was a federal government and a state government. Now it's a national government and a state government. And both the national government and the state government are emergency war powers, military governments, acting upon the citizen deemed an enemy belligerent, living in an occupied territory, be it his county or his state. In the judicial and commercial grants in the Constitution, that wisdom is especially apparent at this time, in 1850, when the commercial era, this is the era of the robber barons, when they're building the railroads and oil with the Rockefellers and others, with its new means and its new discoveries, is opening before us a most conspicuous and responsible career among the nations. To me, it is quite clear that those grants, in all the plenitude of their simple and comprehensive phraseology, convey to the general government, at the time it's the federal government, now it's the national government, after 1868, only what is necessary to secure the equality and fraternity of the states, and the strength and respectability of the Union. With 50,000 miles of coast and shore navigable waters, no one can estimate the extent of our future commerce or the value to us of a system of commercial law with its course of procedure uniform throughout the nation and harmonious with that of the rest of the world. This system of commercial law is Admiralty jurisprudence. And Admiralty jurisprudence would be put on all the states in this uniform system of commercial law after 1953, when every state would be adopting the uniform commercial code that springs from Admiralty jurisprudence, that would guide all of its commercial life and decisions. But it's the emergency war powers military government that sits in an Admiralty jurisprudence that treats every case as a commercial transaction, and hence the fittingness of an Admiralty jurisprudence in every emergency war powers military due process of law, state and federal. He goes on, the following work is but an attempt to present the American view of the subject in such a light as to exhibit its proper importance and to make it practically useful. If it comes up to the intention of the author, it will take a place left unoccupied by the highly useful works on Admiralty practice which have previously appeared. Remember, Mel Stamper in his work, Fruits from a Poisonous Tree, tells you that all the attorneys are trained in Admiralty jurisprudence in all the law schools. It's just not called that. They just don't call it that. But that's how it's proceeding. Mel Stamper was one of the few honest lawyers of the 20th century. He later left the country, went to Puerto Rico, and died there. Continuing, his purpose was so to exhibit the subject that the most inexperienced learner, as well as the riper professional student, could not fail in reading it to have his mind interested in the subject and be directed to the means of settling to his satisfaction its general principles as well as its practical details. He has endeavored to avoid a common error in elementary books of practice of writing for those only who already understand the subject, leaving the beginner to pick up by experience and observation those rudimental principles and directions which to him are of the first necessity. This has led to the insertion of each portion of the work, the jurisdiction, that would be the Admiralty jurisdiction, the practice, that's the Admiralty procedure, and the forms of many things which to some may seem unimportant. Well, this is really important because when you look at the practice of Admiralty and its mode of procedure in this book, you see that it's identical with the mode of procedure in all the federal and state courts today, where every defendant has a surety. In a practical manner, nothing can well supply the place of that emphasis and distinctness which come from the visible illustrations. The practical forms are, for that reason, very full and various. They commence with the entire proceedings in an Admiralty suit, consecutively arranged, and embrace numerous and important classes of maritime cases presented under various aspects. As precedents from actual practice, they are intended to inculcate and illustrate principles as well as to serve for practical forms, and it is believed they may be read with profit, if not with interest. I'll say so, especially now, Erastus Benedict. In offering the work to the profession, the author makes no apology for some obvious departures from the common standard of excellence, which professional as well as literary criticism may find occasion to censure. They have adopted as a part of his plan, and in general manner and substance, the book is what he intended to make it. If it fails to give to the reader a theoretical and practical view of, quote, cases of admiralty and maritime jurisdiction, unquote, and of the practice of, quote, courts of admiralty as contradistinguished from courts of common law, unquote, the author has not accomplished his purpose. Well, remember, we know at law in Article 3 of the Constitution means at common law. And admiralty maritime jurisprudence is just as that. That's the specific jurisprudence. Common law jurisprudence, equity jurisprudence, admiralty jurisprudence. Three separate distinct jurisprudences. Now all combined under emergency war power military jurisdiction with the rules of civil procedure as well as the rules of criminal procedure. And that's all going to proceed pursuant to admiralty mode of procedure. It's not admiralty jurisdiction. It's admiralty mode of procedure where every defendant has a surety. Going on, in printing a new work from manuscript, verbal and typographical errors seem to be unavoidable. A few of them are noticed in the errata, and the reader is requested to make the corrections with a pen. Erastus C. Benedict, New York, 1850. In conclusion, dear listener, America has been under emergency war powers military jurisdiction for 90, military government for 90 years since yesterday. I'll say that again. America has been under emergency war powers military government since March 9th, 1933, which as of yesterday is 91 years. 91 years we have been living under military government. And nobody told us. Nobody told us in high school. Nobody told us in college. Nobody told us in the churches. Nobody told us, because you don't have the right to know, boy, enemy, belligerent, person. And so we have been brainwashed and trained in the education that the educators have imbibed upon us, so as though we will not know this. And yet we can't figure out why the Constitution isn't functioning. No state shall make anything but gold and silver coin a tender in payment of debt. Well, why do we have only worth people promissory notes, Federal Reserve notes? Why do we only have that? That's not redeemed in gold or silver coin. Why do we have that? Because we're under military government, under the doctrine of necessity. And according to the Lieber Code, one of the first things a conquering army does is he confiscates all the public money. That's Article 31 of the Lieber Code, brought into the Hague Convention, which America is being run now under the Hague Convention. It's a convention, it's a treaty governing how occupying armies and military governments are to treat the occupying peoples and the occupied government, the occupied people. We all should have been taught that. I've been to several large churches in Houston, one big, large Southern Baptist church. And what do they got there? They have the military colors, emergency war powers military colors there. They have flag trimmed with gold fringe. And the priest, the pastor, I should say, will never tell you why it's flying there. When's the last time you went to a school board meeting and you see the military colors up there? When's the last time any of you ever asked anybody there, hey, why do you have military colors flying at our school board meeting? Next time you go into your bank and you see the military colors there, why don't you ask the banker, the one in charge, why do you fly in military colors here in your bank? You need to start asking that question. That's the question they don't want to hear. And remember, whenever you ask a question, always know the answer. And I've given you the answer. That flag is a military color pursuant to Army Regulation 840-10. American flag trimmed on three sides with gold yellow fringe, 2 to 2.5 inches long. That's a military color. and that's what is flown in a military courtroom. And you go into any courtroom and you will see military colors on display, and you ask the judge, "Judge, why do you have military colors on display in this courtroom? Is this a military courtroom? Is this a military jurisdiction? If it is it federal or is it state, Judge? Please tell me." We need to start asking these questions, because they're going to impose martial law out of Proclamation 2039-2040. They're going to continue military government and phase it into martial law, and all the courts are set up to try all the enemy belligerents with emergency war powers, military jurisdiction, and ship you off to the concentration camps called the FEMA death camps. They're going to give you a certain appearance of due process, but it's military and it's war powers, and you're an enemy belligerent. And it will be the national judgment of God on a nation of people having corrupted itself, having given itself over to fornication, given itself over to idolatry with all these sports idols and you name it, given itself over to racial miscegenation and race mixing so there'll be no more white race in North America. And when the whites are gone, there is no political liberty anywhere. There is no black nation, there is no Hispanic nation, and there's no Asian nation that ever imposed political liberty apart from white people who read the Bible and were armed with guns and had patriotic leaders like Oliver Cromwell and George Washington and William of Orange and a host of others. Isn't it time we did something? And what's the solution to this? The solution is you need to take my class and become the pre-March 9th, 1933 private citizen of the United States and have the protection of the Hague Convention and Section 1 of the 14th Amendment. The 14th Amendment now protects you. The 14th Amendment, Section 1, is a two-edged sword. It can cut you or it can be a weapon in your hand for your defense. You're guaranteed a civilian due process of law in Section 1 of the 14th Amendment on a state level. You're guaranteed a civilian due process of law on a federal level by the 5th Amendment. Your most important right is a civilian due process of law. Civilian due process of law is a fundamental right for the pre-March 9th, 1933 private citizen. And every judge has taken an oath to uphold the Constitution. So, hold him to his oath. I'm the private citizen, a matter of public judicial record. And now do you intend to uphold the Constitution, Judge? Well, if you do, then that means I demand my right to civilian due process of law. And if you're not going to give it to me, I demand you recuse yourself. Step off the bench. Get down. You've taken an oath. You're going to be in breach of your oath to give me civilian due process of law if you don't give it to me. You try to give me this military due process. I don't consent to this. It's my important right. Your most important right of all rights, dear listener, is your right, your fundamental right to civilian due process of law, protected on a federal level, national level by the 5th Amendment and the 7th Amendment, and protected on a state level by First Section 1 of the 14th Amendment. We have to go there. We have to become one of we the people again. No, you're not going to become a sovereign. That's all nonsense. You're going to become one of we the people again, of the preamble. And then you will advocate that your state declare its independence from District of Columbia, Rome and the Potomac, totally controlled by the Jesuits and the Pope, to our own detriment, to our own destruction, because they're right now planning on a Chinese invasion of the West Coast after they take Taiwan, and then they're going to sweep up and take Hawaii, then they're going to take California, and then we're going to be invaded by a huge Mongol host. That all of their technology was given to them by Billy Boy Clinton and previous presidents. District of Columbia, run by the Jesuits, has armed our enemies to come and take us over, to conquer us. And if we're in sin, if we're in pornography sin, if we white people are having meth, taking meth all the time, and having cocaine, and if you blacks are taking, what is it all, what are the things, what's that, crystal meth, or whatever it is, engage in fornication, pornography. By the way, the city of Memphis, as I understand, 95% of the black children born there are all illegitimate. You think you can build a country on illegitimacy and bastardry and fornication and adultery? It's ripe for judgment. And the Lord's going to bring the Chinese over here and the Russians and the Muslims. And you wait till the Turks get here. I hate to think of that day. The only way out is true repentance and faith. repentance towards God the Father, and faith towards the Lord Jesus Christ, that he died for your sins, was buried, and rose again. And upon believing the true gospel of 1 Corinthians 15:1-4, the Lord will save you, place you in the body of Christ, and you will now be forever secured in him. Now you will have the ability to resist the devil and his papacy by changing your status, and then secondly, by calling for your county or your state to declare its independence from the District of Catholics, the District of Communists, the District of Columbia, the District of the Pope, and we can become a sovereign nation once again, trusting the Lord for protecting us and securing us as we make that righteous movement, because a Declaration of Independence is white, it is historically Protestant, it is Calvinistic, and the only nations that have ever done it have been historically white, Protestant, and Calvinistic. And we can do it again. Returning to the Reformation Bible of the AV 1611 for English-speaking peoples, the Reformation Bible, the Luther Bible for the German-speaking peoples, etc., etc. But we have to go back to God's book, be saved, live by his principles, do the right thing in calling for separation from District of Columbia on your state or county level, and let the Lord do with what seemeth good to him. Brother Eric John Phelps, thank you for tuning in today. I have a book, Vatican Assassins, Wound in the House of My Friends. Please go to my website, vaticanassassins.org. Purchase the ebook. Pray for some of my endeavors that I'm involved in right now, that the Lord would bless them. Send your gifts to Cash App, which is Eric John Phelps, capital E, lowercase R-I-C, capital J, lowercase O-N, capital P, P-H-E-L-P-S, Eric John Phelps at Cash App, or you can give, send a donation to rbpbdonate@comcast.net, Reformation Bible Puritan Baptist Church, rbpbdonate@comcast.net, or you can send a check to P.O. Box, to RBT. RBT, P.O. Box 306, Newmanstown, Pennsylvania, 17073. I appreciate your gifts, and I trust you appreciate what I have taught you over this last hour. May the Lord give us a desire to do the right thing, because the night is coming for America when no man worketh. Until next time, appreciate your prayers, 2 minutes a day, lifting up holy hands without wrath and doubting. And I'll be with you again, Lord willing. Maranatha, the Lord is coming.